Hey there, welcome to Latina to Latina. I'm Alicia Menendez, your host and contributing editor at Bustle.
I like that there's a story for little girls that teaches them that they can win if they're good and they don't give up. And I think that that's actually like a big recurring theme in my life, is that if I work hard and I don't give up, maybe I'll win like my character did.
This episode, I'll be talking to Cristela Alonso. When we met 4 years ago, she was on her way to making TV history as the first Latina to create, produce, and star in a network sitcom. She's amazing. But all that career stuff is nothing compared to the actual in-person magic that is Cristela Alonso. All the talent, none of the ego.
You've lived one of the things on my bucket list, which is voicing in my case, a Disney character.
Yes.
You voiced a Pixar character.
I'm a toy. I'm a Latina toy.
What came with that was friends from high school reaching out and asking you if you would like call their kid to be like, hey, it's Cruz Ramirez.
You know, it's funny because I get people that say, do the voice for my kid. It's my voice. So I just talk.
Hi.
Yes. So I'm like, hi, this is Cruz. And you can tell they're so disappointed. Like, they wanted me to turn into a yellow car right in front of them. Like, I'm a transformer. It's my voice. It's my voice.
You guys. Was it cool?
It was awesome. I got the job. I'll be honest. I had been asked to do The View, and I turned down The View. I loved The View, and I loved the women on The View. But when you know it's not for you, you just can't make it work. And I said no. And again, my agents were like, what are you doing? This is dumb. And I said, no, it's just my heart's not in it. And I can only do things that I want to do. And 2 weeks later, I got the Pixar meeting. And it was so secretive. They didn't tell me why I was going. One of my agents called me and said, do you want to go to Pixar? And I'm like, I guess. Like, it's such a random, I'm like, do you have a Groupon? Like, why are we going? I don't understand. So they didn't give me any details. I went to Pixar. They gave me the super private tour. Couldn't take pictures. And then they start telling me about Cars 3. And then I'm like, well, that's cool. Good for you guys. I hope it works out. Because I didn't know I was auditioning for it. I didn't know they were considering me for it. And then they asked me to read some lines. And I was like, oh, you want me to be that character? And they're like, yeah, didn't they tell you? And I was like, no. So I auditioned for it. And 2 days later, I got the call, which came at the perfect time. I was in Canada doing a stand-up tour. Someone had stolen my identity. I lost my credit cards. I was completely no money, no nothing.
Can I get an advance on that?
Yeah, I had no money. And I remember I walked 2 miles to this bank. It turned out to be an office. It wasn't a bank. It was mortgages. I lost it. And at that point, I was miserable. I got the call saying that I got Cars 3, and I was like, yes. And I started working with them, and I found out that originally my character Cruz Ramirez was a boy, and then they decided to make it into a girl because they wanted to introduce a girl character to show that girls could race too. And I was like, I love that already. Great, love it. Then I started reading the lines, and it was a small role, and they were like, oh, it's no big deal. You'll come in, you'll do some lines, you'll be done soon. So they started flying me up from LA to Oakland, to Emeryville, where they're based. So my daily commute started being flying up to do lines. And I was in the booth, and I was in there with the director and, with some of the writers. There were maybe 4 people with me at all times. And between breaks, I would tell them stories about growing up in South Texas and just different little stuff. And they started adding lines that I've said into the script. And then I said, oh, my God. And I even noticed it. I'm like, I said that. I remember I said that. And this part started growing more. They kept rewriting it. And then they kept adding more of the stuff that I was talking about. And one of them actually became the heart of the movie, which was me dealing with imposter syndrome and just feeling that I'm not going to be good enough. I'm going to be caught. People are going to find out I'm not, that I don't deserve to be there.
Dream small, Cruz. That's what my family used to say. Dream small or not at all. They were just trying to protect me. But I was the fastest kid in town, and I was gonna prove them wrong.
What happened?
When I got to my first race, I figured it out.
What?
That I didn't belong.
When I was younger, my family used to tell me that because that's what they had been told. So when I was a kid, I told them that I wanted to act and I wanted to perform and write. And they were like, yeah, but that doesn't happen for people like us. Like, be more realistic. Get a realistic dream. And I was like, no, I think I can do it. Like, I really want to do it. And they're like, no, like, you are not like that. Dreams like that are for people with money. You don't have money. Like, be more real. Be wise with your choices. And I told Pixar that story, and I told them how my mom used to always tell me to dream small so that I wouldn't be disappointed. And I was telling her that I just really always wanted to try, because even if I failed, I felt like I won because I at least tried. I didn't have to wonder. I had no regrets. And I remember telling Pixar, like, there was a moment that, you know, every moment that I go into a room, even now, where I know that I'm going to be the only one of my kind, there's always a second where I realize, where I wonder, is this the moment that they find out that I don't belong here? Is this the moment that my family pretends that like, if my family thinks, you know, when I find out that my family's right? And they were just, I didn't know this. The next time I went up, that was a big scene in the movie. And they had me read it, and I bawled while I read it. And I think that's the take we used, because it was just so, I couldn't believe it. Like, I couldn't believe that. And it was that thing where Pixar said, we felt the heart of Cruz when you said that. And we realized that's what Cruz was. So we want to give Cruz the chance to win because you won. And I told them, I haven't won, but I love that Cruz is going to win because I love that Cruz is going to win because that shows me that if I'm Cruz and she gets to win, then maybe I get to win eventually too. And that became, the whole character grew where, you know, spoiler alert, adults listening to this podcast, Cruz wins the race at the end and she gets to accomplish her big dream of being a racer. And I remember when they screened it, they said Pixar screens
it
privately.
Crying more or less than I'm crying now?
I was probably crying less just because I don't.
Like, listen, well, get it together, lady.
No, yeah, well, you know, honestly, I was crying less, and I'll be honest with you, I was crying less because one of the biggest problems I have is that I'm very hard on myself. I have very low self-esteem. I don't think that I deserve anything I get, but I work really hard. So I accept that I get things because I work hard, but I don't think I deserve them. And it's because I was raised to think like that. So I was crying because I couldn't believe that someone acknowledged my story as being special, because no one ever tells me that I'm special. So it's that thing where it's hard for me to accept it. You know, even when the movie was done, I couldn't believe that it took a time. I don't even think I've really accepted that I was part of it. Pixar did that, like a secret screening outside of Phoenix. And I remember they came back and said that there's a moment where Cruz wins the race at the end. And the kids and everybody in the theater applauded because they didn't see it coming. And the thing that really I found moving, but also heartbreaking, were that there were little girls that they told me, Pixar told me there were little girls at this screening that thought they didn't understand the movie because they weren't used to girls winning. They were asking their parents, did the girl really win? And that was heartbreaking. But at the same time, I was so grateful that Pixar let that character exist. And, you know, Coco came out afterwards, and everybody loves Coco. And I'm not saying that because I'm playing Cruz Ramirez, but I think that we also need to acknowledge the existence of Cruz before Coco, too, because Cruz came out in the summer, and she was a Latina character that wasn't Latina. Cruz Ramirez and Coco can exist in the same company. They can be created by the same people. We need more representation of different kinds to show that
we're all very different and our stories can be different, but we all come from the same place, you know? And for me, Cruz Ramirez, Cars 3, is probably the best thing I've done, because I say that kids are the ones that we have to really be cautious with. We have to be careful with our words around them. We have to be careful with what we do in front of them. We have to teach them early that their voices matter and that they matter, because when they're not told that, when they're not taught that as children, we grow up to be cynical adults that think that change is pointless. And I like that there's a story for little kids, especially little girls, that teaches them that they can win if they're good and they don't give up. And I think that that's actually like a big recurring theme in my life, is that if I work hard and I don't give up, maybe I'll win like my character did.
Crystal, here's my favorite thing that happens on Twitter. Someone finds your show, Cristela, for the first time. They watch it. They're like, this show is amazing. I love this show. And then they tweet at you, when's your show coming back?
There's people that watched it when it was on the air that still ask me when second season is coming. And I'm like, that was almost 4 years ago, you guys. Let it go. Let it go.
It's such a unique experience for the rest of your life, no matter what you do from here on out. You are now the first Latina to ever create, produce, write, and star in your own television show. Now, with some time and distance, what does that mean to you?
It means that it allows me to do other things that, unfortunately, I think at the same time allows me to be the first one to do other things, which reminds me that it's very sad that I'm the first one to do things. When I did Cars 3, I was the first Latina lead in a Pixar movie, and it was a big deal for them because they had never done that before. Every time I do a stand-up show, I always have a Latina that comes up to me and tells me that their show helped them somehow. And it's funny how when people are hungry for representation, they cling on to something and they see what they want to see, the message that allows them to do things. So for me, I love when people discover the show, and I love that people get what they want. At the same time, though, I hate that I didn't get more of an opportunity to work on the show, especially right now in the time that we're living in.
Yeah, can you imagine that show in this moment?
Yeah, because my whole life is based on really thriving in these moments and like really trying to bring out a voice that is never featured, never focused on. And I think that's a little heartbreaking. That's annoying.
It was largely sort of in the format of shows that you had grown up loving. You know, these like multi-cam family sitcoms. And it was inspired by your experience as a Mexican-American growing up.
Yeah, it was actually a time in my life where I actually moved in with my sister to help take care of her kids. I helped raise her kids, three kids. In the show, there were two, because three kids is expensive.
Lots of tutors on set.
Exactly. So I had moved in with my sister. I was taking care of my mom. She was sick. I was taking care of the kids. And I wanted a show where the woman didn't need to find love. You know, because I feel like every time we see a single woman, a lot of times it's her trying to find her perfect match. And for me, I wasn't really allowed to at that time. I had other responsibilities. I wasn't special. I knew a lot of women in my position, but we don't have shows about them. We don't talk about them at all. You know, I thought that was really groundbreaking to actually show a single woman that didn't necessarily think about getting married because she was the aunt.
But how funny, we never talked about your show as a feminist show.
No, because...
It was too busy being a Latino show to be a feminist show, and it couldn't possibly be both.
Absolutely. You know, it was that thing where I was the fish out of water at work. I worked in a law firm, and my boss in the show was actually based on an old boss I used to have that was super Republican. He would threaten to fire me if I didn't read Ann Coulter books, because he wanted me to learn, like, the right way to do things.
And I like your play on right there.
Isn't that crazy? Like, he would leave the books on my desk and he would say, this is her new book, you should read it. And he would quiz me on it to see if I read it, and I would have to read it. And it was that thing where you read it and you just kind of realize that you're the problem as you're reading it. You're just like, well, this is not a love letter to me at all.
But silly Cristela.
I know. Hey, guys. But I do think, in a weird way, I think that just the way that we are as a society, we go through trends. And I think that a lot of people use movements as trends. I don't mean the people involved in the movement. My God, no. But I think that my show is very feminist. And I think it was maybe a year before the feminist movement kind of took off, where everybody was kind of accepting that it was going to be around. You know, if my show had probably come out during the time that the Women's March had come out.
Or just in the peak of Donald Trump.
Yes. In a weird way, I was predicting the future. I did a Netflix special. And I remember,
lower classy.
And in the special, I remember we were shooting it in San Antonio and we shot the first show. And one of the Netflix executives came up to me, and this is obviously before Trump won. And he said, do you want to change the jokes and change maybe the pretense and change some of the stuff? Because he probably won't win. And I was like, no, we have to leave it like that. It's a snapshot of where we are in this country. We can't deny that it's happening. And the special came out a year ago, and it's more relevant now than it was a year ago. And it's that thing where it's kind of frightening to see how accurate it is. And when you look back on my show, it's kind of weird to see how accurate it is now. I feel that both my special and my show were about like a year or two before its time, which I think is really sad. I always said during the production of my show, my show will probably not last, but the next one that gets the opportunity will last.
Oh, I hate that you were right about that. Because, you know, I think one of the things in the few years, and even though we're in different industries, there's an overlap because it all sort of is under the media umbrella.
Yes.
One of the naivetes I had coming into this business was that it was an escalator and it was up, 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 up. And that each big opportunity, if I worked hard, as I always knew I would, did my best,
yes,
would lead to a bigger opportunity. So not the way this actually works at all. And I wish that the humility I've earned was not earned. I had just come in knowing that. Because you really end up having your ass handed to you.
I was talking to my therapist about this week. I was telling him that I actually wonder how, because at times I struggle with depression. And I think a lot of it comes from that. From the idea that you're taught as a kid that if you're nice and you work hard and you're a good person, things will happen. And they can. But in certain industries, in certain things that you choose to go into, you realize that it's not enough. And when you do all those things.
And on top of that, you're also extraordinarily talented.
Yeah.
And exceptional in a number of ways. But this is also not a business that's a meritocracy.
Absolutely. And it's weird because I guess in certain industries, in certain jobs, statistics matter. I kind of wish we had that scale on this job where I can look at peers and say, you're not good at this. And, you know, be told, like, you're not good at this. I think that when you grow up having this idea, when people tell you, and look, they mean well, and you should be a good person, and you should work hard, and you should be nice. But you also have to realize that if things don't work out the way you wanted them to, that's not your fault. And I think that a lot of times we tend to look inwards and think, what did I do wrong? And we have to understand, you didn't do anything wrong. It's just, it wasn't your time or it wasn't your thing. I say this a lot in talks where people always say, oh, my prayers weren't answered. And I always say, well, they were. The answer was no.
And you're like the opposite of a motivational speaker.
Like, why try so hard? It's all pointless. Everybody, my seminar's $5.
Walk on this fire.
I know. It's going to burn and you'll learn nothing, but walk on it. Like, you know, I'm like the anti-Tony Robbins.
How do you work around the fact that you will probably never be fully embraced?
You know, I think, a couple things.
Well, first of all, do you think that's fair?
Yeah. Actually, I think that the people that want to be in the writer's room, the people that want to get a show, the people that want to do that, you should absolutely do that. I think that what would help is that if more people like me that have been in that situation can go back and tell people that are coming up what to expect.
So what do you expect?
You know, like, well, in a writer's room.
What is a writer's room?
A writer's room, for me, my personal experience, was being told no a lot, on my show.
But, like, what do? Like, you sit around and, like, jam?
Yeah, we actually basically have, you know, like, imagine a cliche 80s movie. Like, it's a corporate room and somebody, like, long table and everybody's sitting at these tables and somebody comes in and they're like, I've sold you, you know, I've bought the company, you're all fired. You know, like, it's that kind of table where there's just a lot of people sitting around. And we have a whiteboard that has the episodes that we're going to do. And we start pitching stories. And because the show was so close to me, I wanted to do stories that were a little different, but also I wanted them to be different from other sitcoms. Because, you know, when you see a lot of sitcoms, you kind of, you know which ones are coming. You know, sometimes they're very typical. And I just wanted everybody to work as much as I did. And I wanted people to care as much as I did. And you realize that.
Oh, please.
That was me. It was me being naive, me not having anybody. You know, when people ask me, who's your mentor? I'm like, no one. Who do I have? I don't have anybody that I can go to and ask for advice. People barely acknowledge that I did the show.
But on Twitter, they do.
Well, I mean, the industry doesn't acknowledge that I did my show.
A lot of the reviews for your show, one of the big takeaways was that you were a huge star.
Yes.
As an actor.
Yes, yes, yes.
Which has got to be sort of affirmed. Like, did you, like, walk around with those to be like, told ya?
You know that I actually never read any reviews.
Were good.
I never read any of the reviews. You know, there was this thing. There's a show called Iconoclast that was on Sundance years ago. And they would put two people that really respected each other's work, and they would have a conversation for an hour. This is pre-podcast. And, you know, there was an episode with Dave Chappelle and Maya Angelou. And it's an amazing conversation. But Maya Angelou has a moment where she says, don't pick it up, don't put it down. And she breaks down how you can't listen to praise, because if you do, you have to listen to criticism too. You can't just pick one. And for me, once I heard that, I took it to heart. I didn't read reviews. I didn't like that, because then she had such a great point where if you do read the good things, then you have to accept the bad things for what they are. And if you do that, how on earth can you do honest work if you're always wondering what people are going to think of you? Mm-hmm. And I didn't read any of them. I don't Google myself. I don't do anything. The only time I hear anything about myself is when people go out of their way, thank you, Twitter, to tell me how awful of a person I am on Twitter, but they're always anonymous. And I always tell...
They're in St. Petersburg, babe.
I tell people, I'm like, babe, you believe in things you like, you believe in it so much you have to do it anonymously. Like, come on, like... That's adorable, you know?
Yeah. Why is this an egg? Put a picture up here.
Exactly. I'm like, I'm putting my picture up. You do it too.
Okay, the show actually gets picked up, which is like nothing short of a miracle.
Yeah.
It gets called, because you didn't read the press and I did, it gets called The Little Show That Could.
Yes.
And, you know, I always thought, like, well, not knowing anything, knowing like, well, if the script is good and it's produced well and it finds an audience, then like that's it. But like there are all these other decisions, like time slot.
Yes.
How promoted a show is,
yes.
What your lead-in is.
So, and I didn't know this. It matters what studio owns it.
How to explain that
so,
to me.
So, like, I didn't know. My show was owned by 20th Century, and 20th Century would basically lease the show to ABC, which means that ABC had to pay a lot of money to rent my show so that they can broadcast it, basically. You know, with my show... The marketing money goes down because he already had to pay money to rent the show. So just by a technicality, by business sense, if you want to create a show right now on network TV, you should try to create it within their own studio. That's how you get more support. No one told me that. I had no idea. So I didn't know why the marketing was different. I didn't know why it was really lopsided, the shows that were owned by ABC Studios and my show. And then... You discover what people think of you with the marketing. We had a pitch that I fought really hard, and I it's a podcast, so I can't show it. I'm gonna show you a picture of the first promo picture that they had for my show that was so so offensive that I
did. They wrap you in a tamale? Like what? What was
it? Just it was me. It really was the same picture that they used, which I hated. They told me they weren't going to use that picture. They told me we were going to reshoot it, and they totally didn't. And they used the picture I hated in the first reincarnation. It was me wearing a quinceañera crown. And each little point in the quinceañera crown had the letter of my name, and it said Cristela.
See, I was worried that my tamale comment was over the line, but now I feel actually pretty good about it.
And then at the bottom, it said, meet the new reina of comedy. So it was like, basically like, if the poster could speak, it would be like, ay, 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 ay. Like, it's just terrible. Yes, like mariachi sounds everywhere, piñatas being hit, everything. And I was mortified. I was just like, we can't do this. Everybody's going to hate this show. Please don't do this. And I didn't know that I didn't have a say in the poster. So I had no idea.
Even as the EP and showrunner.
That, because that's different. That's like, I didn't know. So I had to fight really hard for that. And they didn't like that. Like, they didn't like that I had a problem with all the work that they had done on this poster. And they couldn't understand, you guys, this is kind of offensive. Like, people are...
It's kind of offensive. And that is sort of so... Like, I feel like we don't even need to explain that. Mm-hmm. I feel like the other part of it, though, is that you've spent 10 years investing in the person and brand, Cristela Alonso.
All to have it shut down by someone else in a minute.
Because I think it's what people don't understand. It's even if you think you get it, I think you can't until you've had the experience yourself.
Absolutely.
The viewer or the person who's consuming that won't be able to differentiate the choice that was made on your behalf from you. So no one's going to, people are going to look at that poster and say, wow, that Cristela Alonso, what a dum-dum.
Everybody thinks that I do everything. And that was one of the things that in
which,
the...
Which, P.S., you sort of do outside of...
Yes.
Like,
yes.
You are both, like, a website builder and your own graphic designer. Yeah.
I do.
Your own makeup artist.
Yes,
so.
I do it all. I do it all. I always say that you learn to do things out of need. So it's like, I needed to do it. I didn't have money. So I learned how to code. I learned how to build my site. I built everything. I did everything by myself. The thing is that I've
decided to just pursue strategic incompetence, where I walk around to all my friends and I'm like, I don't know about websites. Does anybody know how to put on fake lashes?
I actually had to drop out of college to take care of my family. Yeah. And what I did, I used to ask my friends to send me what they were studying, their curriculum, and I learned it by myself. So
you're seeing the Good Will Hunting remake, right?
So I actually learned a lot of the stuff that they were learning from YouTube, and I would buy my own textbooks that they were doing it, and I would read them on my own. That's how I learned stuff. I actually went to my own university that I created, and it was all based on the curriculum that I was getting given by my friends. So I learned everything. That's why I tell people, we live in a time right now where if you can't afford to go to college, that doesn't mean that that's an end to it.
One of the things I watched you run into with the show was the fact that it was a Mexican American family, and because there are so few shows or such little content about Latinos, a lot of the feedback was, "Well, this isn't my family."
Yes.
Well, you're not me.
Yeah.
And our mutual friend Jose Antonio Vargas has a secondhand quote, so forgive me if this should be attributed. I attribute it to Jose, but. Do you know when we met, I kept calling him Jose Antonio. And he was like, you know, that's not my name, right? I'm just Jose. Like, okay. So, but Jose had a mentor, I think, at the Washington Post who said, there's universality in specifics. Be specific.
Yes.
Don't make a pan-Hispanic show.
Yes.
Make it, like, very, very specific about, like, these are Mexicans in Texas. And,
yes.
Like, this is specific. I just don't know how you get around that feedback loop where people, because they don't have Latino shows, are then mad that the one Latino show isn't.
Well, you know, I think that we have to, in order to fix that, we do need more content. And actually, I believe in that so much, the specificity. That's why I made it a point to set the show in Dallas. That's why I made it a point to say that we were Mexican American, because I also wanted to show a lot of times when we see Latino culture in mainstream, you know, pop culture, we always don't know what they are. And even what we're known as Latino, but we really, you know, and it's weird because when you do know what they are, they're usually Puerto Rican or Cuban, some Mexican, but not really, you know, it's very, really Puerto Rican Cuban. And I think that by being specific and saying what you are, you actually let people know how many more variations of Latino there are.
Especially when I believe the number is that 80% of Latinos in the U.S. are Mexican.
Yes. It's like something ridiculous. I go, we're all Mexican. You know, you know?
This like, is the let me save you money on your ancestry DNA test.
This is the point where like someone hears me say that and starts tweeting at me. I'm not Mexican. You know? But yes.
Okay. But here, but to underline the point for someone who is listening and having that freak out moment, it is that given that the vast majority of Latinos in this country are Mexican or Mexican American, then the fact that the majority of content or representation is of people like myself who are Cuban, Cuban American, or Puerto Ricans, that ratio is the problem.
And it's weird. Yes. And you know, what's interesting to me is that, you know, I think that people, the Latino community is very hungry for representation. You've seen it in media. Everybody, like right now, people are saying, they're talking about Latinos, the lack of Latino presence in the Oscar nominations. And what do we do? And what do we do? And we have to realize that it's not a quick fix. And we've been trying to do it for decades, for years, but we're not there yet. And, you know, I say this in regards to anything. We have to try, not just because we think that we're going to change things, but we have to keep trying and along the way think, I hope I'm moving the needle and understand that it's a long process. But when Latinos are hungry for representation, they judge everything. A lot of times some of them judge things very harshly because it has to be perfect. And no perfect show exists.
Can I be on your podcast? Because this is like a to be, like this is legit to be continued because we still have to talk about so many things. Like I feel like I got to like
we
nothing.
We have to do like another podcast
I didn't get to talk to you about immigration. I didn't get to talk to you about politics in the age of Trump. I didn't get to talk to you about your
Why
comedy
don't we
special.
Do that? Oh my God, that's more important.
Okay, good. That's it for now, but we want to hear from you. Email us at latinatolatina@bustle.com. Send us ideas for awesome guests or whatever it is you're thinking about right now. Remember to subscribe to Latina to Latina on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening. And please leave a review. We love hearing from you. Latina to Latina is produced by Lantigua Williams & Co., mixed by Oluwakemi Aladusui, with assistance from Anna Parsons. Our executive editor is Emily Ann Epstein. Our editorial supervisor is Roseanne Salvatore. And we got to give a special thank you to Jenny Hollander.